So, Joel Dinnerstein here. I ran into Joel based on my work on Lester Young. I came across this great essay that Jay's been reading here in this book, Signifying, Sanctifying, and Slam Dunking, from 1998. And he just told us that this was the first piece that he got published in a professional academic journal. Mm-hmm. And he's been working on elements of this for the last 20 years, I guess. So we're going to be hearing the result of all those 20 years of research.
It won't be here that long.
So he's the author of several works on the history of cool, including, and we have the book back there if you're interested, The Origins of Cool in Postwar America. It's by University of Chicago Press. It just came out in May. He also has a book called Coach, A Study of New York Cool by Rizzoli, 2016. And he was the co-curator of a Smithsonian show called American Cool. That was back in 2014. His first book was Swinging the Machine, a history of jazz and industrialization, and deals with modernity, technology, and African-American culture, as well as several articles on American identity and popular culture, film noir, jazz, literature, technology, sports, and rock and roll. He served as a consultant for popular music and jazz for Putumayo Records, HBO's Boardwalk Empire, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and he's received a student body award for excellence in undergraduate teaching and teaches courses at the intersection of modernism, popular culture, African-American studies, and contemporary literature. He also was a jazz DJ in New Orleans at WWOZ. And he teaches courses on blues, jazz, and New Orleans culture, and has written several insider articles about New Orleans, second-line culture, and is a member of the Prince of Wales Club. Well, you'll have to tell us about that at some point.
Happy to do so.
Yeah. He has a PhD from American Studies from the University of Texas, Austin, and as our director of education always likes to say when she was promoting this event, she makes it clear that Joel was educated exclusively at public schools.
You have no idea how rare that is at the academic level. So yeah,
Joel Dinerstein.
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction, Henry. I want to say a couple things about just to add to Henry's introduction. So the essay that's in the book that Henry was referring to is called Lester Young and the Birth of Cool, which is now chapter one in the Origins of Cool in Postwar America 20 years later, roughly in the same form, although I made a few changes. And Henry, of course, is doing a documentary on Lester Young, who really needs and deserves one. And I'm going to be talking about Lester Young a little bit in terms of cool today. But really, the talk is called Bop Prosody, which was Jack Kerouac's term for both his prose style and his method. And I'm really going to be talking about that, about Kerouac's prose style and his method. Not only how he came to it, why I think it's misunderstood, and why it is actually based on jazz practices in ways that are actually quite accurate. So I'm going to do that through jazz, and I'm going to do that through cool, not because I have a book to sell, but because I think it's one of the useful ways to do it. Before I get started, Jack Kerouac was a huge jazz fan. He began frequenting jazz clubs in Harlem from the moment he moved to New York to go to Columbia University in 1940. He hung out at Minton's, which was the jazz club in Harlem in which bebop, the revolutionary jazz idiom of the time, was invented. And his first wife said that he was there often enough that they asked him to open a charge account, which I don't know if it was a joke, but still. And the other thing is Samuel Charters, who was Jack Kerouac's friend and a great blues and jazz scholar, he said that Lester Young, according to Edie again, offered Kerouac his first joint and first taste of marijuana, all of which sounds entirely possible, and I don't really see why she would be lying. But what's interesting about that is that Kerouac, Lester Young was his cultural hero, not just a jazz hero. He really thought of him in the way that people thought of, like, Elvis, somebody who had actually transformed the possibilities of that generation for him. And Neil Cassady thought the same thing. So that's part of the essay as well. What I want to do to start is actually play one of the most famous Lester Young solos. And it's just a minute long, and it's from Lady Be Good. Is this okay, Henry?
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
And the reason I want to play it, besides that it's really great, but that's not why, is that it's important that a lot of people don't know how to listen to jazz. I don't really know what everyone's experience is with it. But Jack Kerouac really heard solos as if they were nonverbal statements that had the same communicative power as verbal statements. Like, he heard the phrasing and he heard them as sentences and as paragraphs. So a chorus is kind of a paragraph, and one phrase is a sentence or a phrase. And I think it's important to listen, because in this tune, which is Gershwin's Lady Be Good, and we're only going to listen to the solo, it's about a minute long, he takes four choruses. And if you really listen to it as if there's someone speaking, except in nonverbal phrases, I think it will give you real insight into sort of why Kerouac was transformed by jazz practice from his early style. So you'll hear a couple of bars from Count Basie on piano. And what is also historically fascinating about this is that this was literally Lester Young's first recorded solo. And he jumps into it like, I've been waiting all my life to do this. And I will sort of signal when the end of each chorus is, although that doesn't really matter that much. So those are four choruses with four really, really good ideas. And within each chorus, really good internal ideas. They are really poetic. And I really think he heard them that way. And I will sort of refer to this throughout my presentation. I wish I wasn't really reading this, but I'm sort of reading it. So that's the way it goes. So Jack Kerouac was obsessed with the word cool the first time he heard it, or the first times he heard it, in the jazz clubs of New York. It was a description of a new state of mind. It's cool. I'm cool. Everything's cool. These were brand new phrases in the mid-40s in New York, created by and disseminated by jazz musicians, and actually particularly by Lester Young. Kerouac was probably the biggest jazz fan among American writers in the post-World War II era, maybe with the exception of Leonard Bernstein, which is a separate idea. And he began frequenting these jazz clubs in 1940. So in a 1950 letter to Neil Cassady, his friend and muse, Kerouac confessed to being obsessed with this new word and concept. This is the letter. I've been thinking about cool for the past week, almost to the point of a theory. Now, a raw mind and a cool mind are two different minds. The raw mind is associated with the physical life, whether it's athletic, it's about work, or it's just beat. The cool mind is the intellectual emphasis, and the physical counterpart of it is a kind of gracefulness that is almost effeminate. Now, here's the thing. He categorizes himself and Neil Cassidy as more interested in raw mind, which of course is right. That is to say, being open to spontaneous, almost instinctive responses to everything. Organic reactions, sensory stimulation, joyful, even boyish enthusiasm, an omnivorous appetite for new experience. An attitude traceable in American literature back to Walt Whitman and the Whitmanesque. But he recognized cool mind as something brand new, more intellectual among jazz musicians, more feminine and therefore not macho in any sort of way, and with a value on graceful physical movement. This new cool attitude in the New York air had come out of jazz, and as he wrote in the beginning of On the Road, quote, that sound of the night which bebop has come to represent for all of us, unquote. He was obsessed with cool for most of the 50s as a new philosophical cast of mind, and he would use cool to signal an ideal mental state, cool mind, rather than being cool as we might speak about it today. Now, he worshipped, as I've said, Lester Young, who, if you don't know, it's partly because most of his important recordings are not under his own name. They're either under the Count Basie Orchestra or they're under Billie Holiday's name. And the saxophone, he and Billie Holiday were musical soulmates, and especially on her early work, he's the saxophone. And in a sense, Billie Holiday based her vocal style on Lester Young's saxophone style. But importantly, Lester Young brought our modern usage of cool into the American vernacular. All of the musicians of his era, his cohort, all say, in our generation, he was the only one who used it. After him, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, and everybody else uses it, but pretty much it was Lester Young. When he used it, it had four meanings, and this was the basis of my first essay. One is a mode of relaxation in performance and in public. So on stage, you don't look excited. In fact, what is exciting is you are musically being really creative while you are staying physically and emotionally relaxed. That was actually quite revolutionary. He's also about being relaxed in public, which to be physically and emotionally relaxed at ease as an African American in the Jim Crow era was a fairly rare commodity. So being cool was like, I'm cool here, meant I'm relaxed in my own style and I'm comfortable, which was no small achievement. Cool meant a blank, detached facial expression. And it was meant to be a repudiation to Uncle Tommy, that the forced smile of Uncle Tommy that all blacks had to do at their jobs and in public, even in the North, never mind in the South. Jazz musicians were the leaders at basically shaming anybody who then Uncle Tom'd. In fact, by the mid-50s, being called an Uncle Tom as an African-American was worse than the N-word for at least another 10 to 15 years. So the cool mask, as I call it, is a repudiation of Uncle Tomming as a mask. And then to have an original sound or voice in art. Now, this is particularly true in jazz, where if you don't have a sound that anyone can identify within 12 bars as you, you're not actually truly a jazz musician. This is the sort of sine qua non being a jazz musician. So as two recent African-American scholars have written, cool celebrates individuality in African-America. So part of that comes through jazz. And of course, last but not least, the new word signifying anything favorable. We still use it. Like, cool, great, cool, that's cool, right? And the fact that it survived for this long is actually quite interesting. More on that later. So mostly taking all these four things together, cool is an ideal. It meant to be always relaxed and poised in one's own personalized signature style, which is nearly impossible. That's why it's an ideal. So before I continue, a few words about Kerouac's use of the word beat before pursuing cool. Kerouac coined the phrase the beat generation in a 1949 conversation with his friend John Cleland Holmes. He said simply, we are a beat generation. And a word he got from the African-American vernacular in jazz clubs. And it meant, quote, exhausted, tired, worn out. Still means that. And you can find it in Cab Calloway's Hipster Dictionary in 1944, meaning exhausted, tired, worn out. Now, in 49, Kerouac was full of despair, actually, and considered his generation depleted of energy at a young age. This is all fairly common, given anybody with their eyes open after the Holocaust and the concentration camps and nuclear arms race. Yet 8 years later, after On the Road, he began to define beat as meaning angelic or beatific, as in saintly, as in seeking a divine vision. So the new generation was on a spiritual search for renewal, and they were, in Kerouac's terminology, crazy saints and holy goofs, tearing off down the road to seek either corporeal adventures or a new divine vision, depending on your perspective when you read him. So what happened between 1949 and 1957? So what my presentation is about is that Kerouac found two non-Western philosophies that liberated him from both the realist and modern traditions of American literature that he used for his first novel, The Town and the City, which admittedly was based on Thomas Wolfe and never really sold that well. Well, probably still doesn't. But in jazz and Buddhism, Kerouac found approaches to artistic practice and the creative process that liberated his voice. So I'm going to discuss four connections of Kerouac and cool. One, his pursuit of cool mind through both jazz and Buddhism. And I'm going to do this through one of his lesser analyzed works, his Mexico City Blues, which is an epic cycle of poetry. And I'll also refer a little to a book no one talks about, which is Sum of the Dharma, which wasn't published till 1995 and was his Buddhist journal that he thought so much of that his agent, Sterling Lord, what a name, right? Sterling Lord tried to sell, along with all the other books, On the Road, Mexico City Blues. Kerouac thought it was as important. Why he thought his 500-page Buddhist journal would sell, I don't know. But it has many, many clues to actually Kerouac in this period. Second, he was the literary herald of a cultural shift toward improvisation in artistic method and creative spontaneity across the board in everyday life and art. Third, he helped change the meaning of cool for the boomer generation, making it synonymous with personal rebellion and authenticity. And fourth, baby boomer youth and many white bohemians considered Kerouac cool then. Many people still do. And what would happen if I had a PowerPoint right now is you'd see the Gap ad from the 1990s when Kerouac had just said Kerouac wore khakis. And he was one of several icons that the Gap chose. Miles Davis was another one. Joan Didion was one. It's what in my field we call a usable past. Who do you want to actually claim as sort of your heritage to move into the future? So Kerouac was one of them. So I want to analyze Kerouac's quest for cool in the post-war era. And one of the questions he asks in Sum of the Dharma is he says, who wouldn't want to wake out of a nightmare? So, of course, he's echoing James Joyce's key question of modernity from Ulysses. But in jazz, Kerouac heard African-American musicians artistically waking out of their long historical nightmare and forcing America to deal with their individuality and humanity, at least through music and at least through not smiling. In Buddhism, he found an ancient method for controlling the mind, first cleansing it and then cooling it, which he literally calls cooling it, right? This cooling of anger and desire by clearing the mind remains central to cool as a low-key emotional mode. If these associations with cool seem unusual now, consider that the term was replaced in the early 80s by young African-American men for whom cool had been diluted, so it's now chill or be chillin'. And the fact that more linguists have not noticed that this is a really easy slide confounds me. But it still means being relaxed, calm, and having your mind clear in one's own style. All right, so Kerouac often said that one crucial meaning of his term, the Beat Generation, was that theirs was the generation that discovered the beat. Now, this may not be true, but it's interesting. His friend and blues scholar Sam Charters recalled Kerouac often saying, quote, the beat generation is the one that's with the beat in jazz. They're the ones who hear the beat and feel the beat, and that's why they're the beat generation. Another interesting set. So, a jazz solo is, by definition, a realized, spontaneous composition. Right? It's not something you just make up. It's because you have dug deep enough into your own musical abilities and into chords and harmony and melody to be able, spontaneously, to create sort of a new set of changes on the old chord changes. This essential improvisatory practice was for Kerouac the basis for, first, his manifesto, his literary manifesto, Essentials of Spontaneous Prose. Second, his exuberant epic poetry work, Mexico City Blues, and his caffeine-driven, well, speed-driven novel On a Scroll, On the Road. Lester Young was the main influence on his jazz-based philosophy. His other influence was Neil Cassady, whose onrushing, nonstop storytelling style was the verbal equivalent of jazz as an influence on what he would call bop prosody, and which translates into bebop prose or jazz prose. So Kerouac found in the jazz objective of crafting an original sound, so this is second, right? First is improvisation, and second, there's creating an individual voice. He found in that the artistic imperative to find an original literary voice, born of personal experience and signature stylistic gestures. He believed that literary voice and prose style carried ideas and personal philosophy more effectively than eloquence, exposition, character, setting, narrative structure, or dramatic pacing, all the formal elements of literature. As a writer, he wanted from jazz what writer Hetty Jones called, quote, its genius approach to craft, and he took from its artistic way, his method, a way to, quote, sing on my own line in my own good time. He found his voice on road trips, especially with Neil Cassady, because Cassady used language with the kind of raw enthusiasm Kerouac wanted for a literary style, a continuous, spontaneous stream of language broken up by individual stylistic tics, cadences, and choices. For Cassady, life was an all-night jam session fueled by propulsive hedonism, whether speeding down highways or conning multiple women at the same time. Kerouac took from Cassidy's rambling verbosity a model for his own American voice, combining it with jazz practices, and as a turn away from the imitation of Thomas Wolfe in his first novel, The Town and the City. He would never imitate another author again. So, in the same letter, and this is fascinating, to Cassady about raw mind and cool mind, he uses cool as a synonym for finding one's original artistic voice. He realized, and I think partly unconsciously, that cool was related to this creation. Here's what he said. I've also been thinking of cool with regard to my writing. The modern young writer is now faced with the problem of many voices in America. A book always has a voice. Now, since Mexico, I've been trying to find my voice. For a long time, it sounded false, of course. For a long time, I labored on several other variations, such as Thomas Wolfe. My important recent literary discovery is that the voice is all. Now, in 1958, Kerouac wrote a short literary manifesto called The Essentials of Spontaneous Prose, in which he claimed the improvised jazz solo is the model for literary practice. Now, it's a manifesto, so not just for his, but for everybody's, right? By then, Kerouac had been writing long, unpunctuated prose narrative for 7 years, bypassing the formal conventions of literary craft. If you've ever seen The Scroll that he wrote for On the Road, right, the big teletype roll, it has no chapters, no paragraphs, no breaks. There's some crossouts, but either it's a typo or he didn't know what he wanted to say. But basically, it's Kerouac playing his typewriter like a saxophone for 3 weeks, except for sleeping and eating. And he was on speed, so he probably didn't do that much sleeping, right? So it is not really... So he does this, and it bypasses the formal conventions of literary craft. And as writers in the room, as I assume some of you are, it also keeps your censors offline because you're not busy thinking, does this sound good? Is there a better way to say this? He's not worrying about that. So it is not, however, really stream of consciousness, even though people really often call it that. Stream of consciousness is a method with formal objectives of capturing the stream of thought in the mind of a fictional character. Right? You are trying to capture how it works. You're rarely speaking. No one usually speaks in stream of consciousness. So when people call it this, I don't know if they mean that he's writing fast. I don't know that he means that he's trying to document it, but stream of consciousness, as to use Ulysses, is based on famously William James, Henry James' brother, idea of the stream of thought in 1890. And he says that, look, we don't think in formal correct grammar when we think. We don't think in sentences, right? We think as if there are several streams feeding it. Sensory stimulation, memories, thought, emotions, everything at one time. And so if you're going to capture that, you have to actually go in several directions. In stream of consciousness, that's what you're trying to do. Kerouac's never trying to do that. He is constantly distracted when he's writing, but it's usually fairly conscious what a character is doing or thinking. It is actually more akin to a minor Japanese method called automatic writing and sometimes automatic painting. And so automatic painting means when you first put your brush to the page, you don't pick it up till you're done. That's actually what he does, right? It's automatic writing. You sit down, you don't get up till you're finished, and you don't make any changes. So I think that, you know, I just do this because bop prosody is actually a new thing. And it's not stream of consciousness, and it's not really quite automatic writing, but it's something in between. So, like a jazz musician, Kerouac advised writers to find the essential kernel of a given experience. And to do that, you needed structured improvisation. Set the experience in your mind that you wish to write about, like the road trips, and then without revision, capture the raw feelings by just writing. And that means that if you're writing about an event you remember, even if your mind, while you're writing about a year ago, goes off in certain digressions, you assume that that's realistic. It would have done that then, even if they were different digressions. That's how I think about it. I mean, so this is what he wrote. This is in the Essentials of Spontaneous Prose. Writing, capital letters. You'll never know what you wanted to say about something till you're scribbling furiously into it, reaching the center, then scribbling out again. This is blowing, capital letters, which is the jazz verb of the time, and probably still, accidentally and actually finding your center. So when a jazz musician blows, he or she surfs into the core structure of a given song with the intention of creating a new musical pattern on the bones of the chords, the chord changes. Only through long hours of practice can a musician spontaneously compose a coherent artistic statement. Kerouac wrote in his manifesto, struggle to sketch the flow that already exists intact in mind, unquote. And then he clarified this once in a letter to his editor. He wrote, quote, if it isn't spontaneous, right into the very sound of the mind, then we get what a man has hidden, i.e. his craft, instead of what we need, what a man has shown, i.e. blown, like a jazz musician. So it's fairly clear, right? He named his prose style for the then revolutionary jazz edging of bebop. It's a new form of small band music in the early 40s that gave each musician more room for longer solos to make personal statements and sound. He called it boprosody, which was short for bebop prosody, and it translates as bebop prose or jazz prose. Now, a creative jazz solo, like we just heard, requires the shaping of an emotional response from a cool, calm center as supported by other musicians, or else you can't do it. It's not an emotional outpouring. So when Norman Mailer said jazz is orgasm, it's one of the stupidest things American writer has ever written about a musical, about a form he didn't know anything about. To create a personal sound in jazz requires constant interrogation of an individual artistic voice to project a complex subjective consciousness. This is what Kerouac actually understood. So, of course, this manifesto participates in a venerable debate, about fiction and poetry. What is more important, voice or craft? Towards the end of 1950, Kerouac repudiated the craft-driven novel, represented by Thomas Wolfe, and devoted himself to the narrative voice revealed by improvisation. Now, this is going to be an odd jump. Stay with me. Toni Morrison once described her jazz-influenced literary practice in similar ways, if more formally. When writing her novel Jazz, she reflected, quote, I thought of myself as like the jazz musician, someone who practices and practices and practices in order to be able to invent and to make his art look effortless and graceful, unquote. The challenge and reward comes from artistic courage or, quote, the willingness to fail because jazz is a public performance. A jazz performance on stage, Morrison said, does not have, quote, the luxury of revision that a writer has. You have to make something out of a mistake. And if you do it well enough, it will take you to another place where you never would have gone had you not made the error. Unquote. So for Morrison, a jazz musician always, quote, conveys that he has more that he's not going to, but he's not going to give it to you. It's an exercise in restraint and a holding back. That sense of knowing when to stop is a learned thing. Actually, that's one that I'm not sure Kerouac ever learned. Morrison considers the jazz solo a model of artistic thrift, that's our term, of what to conceal and reveal. In other words, spontaneous prose, like jazz, like the jazz solo, has the excitement of immediacy, the potential for revelation, the looseness of experimentation, and the danger of failure. Now, in some ways, Kerouac misunderstood this one central aspect, at least as he conveyed it. And on the road, they often go to jazz clubs. There are many scenes in jazz clubs. And usually those, someone is actually doing an outpouring of emotional responses on stage, which is weird because he seems to understand jazz practice really well. But in these scenes in jazz clubs, you know, usually there are long solos and Dean Moriarty is always cheerleading, go, 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 as if, you know, it's a long guitar solo. But to some extent, this is a mistaken perception. He gives the jazz musician's raw mind in that novel when they have cool minds necessary to the act of improvisation. Yet, in his own literary practice, he illuminates his understanding. So, as he does in On the Road when he has the teletype role for 3 weeks, and he is blowing on it like a on a typewriter, and I want to give two examples of what I mean. One in which I think is a great example of the paragraph in the Literary Manifesto that is not quite successful but really represents what he's saying. And one I think is really successful. And they're both famous, which is to say one is the last paragraph of On the Road, and I'll get to that in a second. And one is the long paragraph that has what's probably the most famous sentence in On the Road, which is about only being interested in the people who are the mad ones, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to read the whole paragraph. It's really long. But it's a page-long paragraph. And if you think about this like a jazz solo, the paragraph's actually about the meeting of Dean Moriarty and Carlo Marx, of Allen Ginsberg and of Neil Cassady. That's what he's. That's what this paragraph's about as a solo. And it starts out as if he just needs to get us there. So it's, we went to New York, I forget what the situation was, two colored girls, there were no girls there, they were supposed to meet him in a diner, didn't show up. And then there's a couple other things in which he's getting to his point. And three sentences in he goes, and that was the night Dean met Carlo Marx. And so for the next, so that's like the moment he figures out what the solo is going to be about. Everything else is just sort of like warming up. And then we get a couple of great sentences. Two piercing eyes, glance at the two piercing eyes, the holy con man with the shining mind and the sorrowful poor con man with the dark mind that is Karl Marx. And now he's getting going. The paragraph's really about that meeting. So he goes and he goes and he goes, and here's what Dean told Carlo, here's what Carlo told Dean. And when we get to the end of what is now like five or six sentences, we get that famous sentence. They rushed down the street together, digging everything in the early way they had, which later became so much sadder and perceptive and blank. That's the sense, I'm sorry. But then they danced down the streets like dingledodies, a word I'm pretty sure he made up. And I shambled after, as I've been doing all my life, after people who interest me, because the only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars. And in the middle, you see the blue center light pop and everybody goes, ah. Oh. It's beautiful. And the paragraph doesn't end there, right? This is why Morrison understood it was thrift. He didn't quite get this, right? Because the next sentence is, what do they call such people in Goethe's Germany? And it doesn't even go back to that. So, like, you have just written a perfect, almost a perfect long sentence. He has this extended metaphor about burning that ends with Roman candles, that has these great clauses that build and build, and he doesn't have the sense to end the paragraph there. But the point is, there's a perfect indication, right? He starts, warms up, he figures out what he wants to say, and after talking about Dean and Carlo, he figures out why it's about him, right? I'm the one who's... These are the people who interest me. Yeah. I'm not really as mad as them. Yeah, yeah. So they fascinate me. Yeah. That's the kernel that he gets in the solo. And that's why he should have ended it there. So he doesn't. But even so, it goes on for three more sentences, all of which are completely unimportant. So it's both an example of spontaneous prose and a reason why, he, whether he's too young or not, he doesn't get the thrift aspect that Toni Morrison got.
Too much Benzedrine.
And possibly too much Benzedrine. But even, you know, well, I won't comment on that. So, but here, but then the last paragraph of the novel, which I think is actually his most perfect jazz solo. And he makes a mistake in the middle, which he doesn't make anything out of. So it's just left there as kind of a beautiful flaw. So here's the last paragraph. And it actually winds up summing up a novel that should be unable to be summarized. Says, so in America, when the sun goes down, I sit on the old broken-down river pier, watching the long, long skies over New Jersey, and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the West Coast, and all that road going, all the people dreaming the immensity of it. And in Iowa, I know by now the children must be crying in the land where they let the children cry. And tonight the stars will be out. And don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in, and nobody, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. I think of Dean Moriarty. I even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. I think of Dean Moriarty. It's beautiful. It's long. He actually does what jazz musicians do with that last line. He like repeats a phrase, right, and finalizes it. And there's that great mistake. What's the mistake? What do you think's the mistake that I just read? Where if you were a jazz musician, you went there and you go, I don't know what to do with that. Don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? I've read this a lot. It's nothing wrong with it. It's just not really related to anything else in the paragraph. So either it's charming or it's just in the middle of the improvisation, something that was going to lead somewhere and he decided that's not going where I want it to go. That's, yeah.
I was just at the Kerouac Festival. He got that directly from Neil's daughter. So when he used to play with his daughter, she would say God is Pooh Bear, and that was something he got directly from Neil Cassidy's oldest daughter.
Well, that's beautiful if we know that when we're reading. But otherwise, I don't really think it belongs, but I'm very happy to know it. And I find it endearing, but I find flaws like that endearing. Like, so that's, I think, and it's perfect that it's also the last paragraph. It's like, here it is. That's what just happened in this novel. And it's like, wow, that's pretty good. So this transforms Kerouac's literary method. There we have it. So I want to insist upon Kerouac's method as a jazz practice. It's not stream of consciousness. He's not representing the interior dialogue of a fictional character as an inquiry into his or her psychology. Yep. That is not what he's doing. He knew what stream of consciousness was. He worshipped James Joyce. He would have called it stream of consciousness if that's what it was. So he calls himself, and this is the next important part, a jazz poet in the epigraph of Mexico City Blues, the work I will turn to now. I'm jumping ahead. I'm going to read. Oh, I don't have it, but it's okay. I don't really need it. At least I think I have it. So the epigraph of Mexico City Blues is, I want to be considered a jazz poet blowing a long blues in an afternoon jam session on Sunday. I take 242 choruses, which is kind of like writing that novel in 3 weeks. My ideas vary and sometimes roll from chorus to chorus or from halfway through a chorus to halfway into the next. And in this case, he is doing automatic writing. He will just put his pen to a page and he's going to write one poem and that's it. And I'm going to come back to that. I just wanted you to have the epigraph first. Because the book either started with a dream and Kerouac worked backwards, or if not, the final four poems are a suite that started with a dream. So in a book that has no characters and themes, but no historical personages, there's only one. It's Charlie Parker, the alto saxophonist who had died about 6 months earlier. And three of the last four courses are directly about Charlie Parker. So I think, but I have no proof, I haven't run down the evidence yet, that he either started with that and worked backwards or knew that that's where he was headed because he wanted it to end that way. And here's why. So around 1953... Kerouac switched from a jazz-based method to a Zen-based method for writing. So why is that? I don't know, but here are the two possibilities, given that he started a 5-year devotion to Buddhist practice. Zen Buddhism offered him a philosophy of active moral and mental action and a religious practice, or at least a spiritual practice. Many jazz musicians understand their art as a spiritual practice, as a way of raising their spirit and of excavating one's own subjective truth, but this was then unknown. In Zen Buddhism, Kerouac had a guide who was a peer, the Zen poet Gary Snyder, and space to pursue it on his own. So without a mentor or ancient text to support the jazz inquiry, in fact, people knew very little about African culture, about African-American culture in the 50s. Kerouac was tempted by an older, more venerable spiritual tradition, Zen Buddhism. And he would mix together, the only time he did, jazz and Buddhism into Mexico City Blues. And this is the part that starts with a dream. In early February of 1955, and I'm trying to see whether I want to do this first. I don't. I want to try your patience and lead up to the dream. Between 1953 and 1956, Kerouac kept an elaborate 2-column journal full of poems, anecdotes, epiphanies, copied out sutras, and internal dialogues concerning the role of Zen Buddhism in what he hoped would be the coming revolution of consciousness. And he entitled it Some of the Dharma. He imagined that there would be a new kind of American pilgrim, a combination of Walt Whitman, Zen monk, and Christian saint. And of course, he imagined he would be like one of the first ones. So here's a self-description, and this is from Dharma Buns. I was very devout in those days. I really believed in the reality of charity and kindness and humility and zeal and neutral tranquility and wisdom and ecstasy. And I believed that I was an old-time bhikkhu, a pilgrim, in modern clothes, wandering the world in order to turn the wheel of the true meaning, or dharma, and gain merit for myself as a future Buddha, an awakener, and as a future hero in paradise. Quite a destiny to set for yourself. He would be the avatar of a democratic, Americanized Zen Buddhism, a future hero in paradise to be judged by Buddhists of the future. He valued Buddhism as an alternative consciousness to Christian guilt, dualism, original sin, deferred gratification, not to mention the complicity of the Catholic and Protestant churches with everything from slavery to the bomb. In Zen Buddhism, Kerouac found religious legitimation for the cool mind. And Zen, in different ways, actually mirrors jazz and cool as a form of affirmation and self-excavation from a calm center, even if it has different objectives in mind. So, Buddhism requires a rigorous daily discipline. Hours of meditation, tutelage by a mentor or master, suppression of ego and desire, be it sexual, economic, or prestige. The ideal in Zen Buddhism is the end of desire, to be perfectly calm in any situation and without ego. Yet Kerouac, with his raw mind full of a search for joy, never had the discipline for Zen Buddhism. But he wrote well about it, and in particular about his own journey. I actually believe it is precisely the tension between his constant quest for calm and his inability to find satisfaction that makes his work compelling reading for restless youth. You know, On the Road still sells 100,000 copies in North America every year. So Kerouac never found the strategic silence either to Zen cool or to African-American cool. As he wrote in some of the Dharma, obtaining nirvana is like locating silence. And he never achieved this stillness of mind. His spiritual dharma lay in his constant hope for visions, as he once wrote, "Man, I want to be enlightened by actions." So he found partial enlightenment for himself, and I actually think great joy, in creating literature about Buddhism and Buddhist-influenced literature. So Mexico City Blues is his only synthesis of jazz and Zen. He writes it, of course, in Mexico City, and it marks the shift from one form to the other in the 50s, from jazz-based to Buddhist-based. And in its final four stanzas, Charlie Parker rises from the dead as a serene, cool American Buddha who blows a wave of blues forward as if to save the future from an apocalypse that felt very near during the first nuclear arms race.